and welcome to All the Horrible Things, episode 53, Beau is Afraid, part one. This is the first time we've ever done a two-parter, Chris. What do you think? Are you nervous?
No, I'm excited. I think ones and twos are great. I think people like a sequel, apparently.
I mean, we're doing more producing than we've ever done before. You know what I mean?
That's right.
We had to think ahead in a new way. But ultimately, we're going to talk about the trailer of Beau's Afraid, our anticipatory thoughts about what is to come. And then as we digest that, we're going to look back on Hereditary and Midsommar, Ari Aster's first two films, so that maybe we have a better sense of where he might go with this new one, because I haven't read any reviews. All I know is what I know from the trailer and the blurb on IMDb. How about yourself? Have you read any reviews yet?
No, I haven't read any reviews, but last night I saw two different people post their reactions, their initial reactions to having actually seen the movie.
Okay.
And it worries me.
Really? What was the general impression?
Yeah. So this one woman was walking out of it and said, you know, how long it was, and that she said something along the lines of, what even was that? And she wants her money back.
Oh my goodness.
Now, what's her name, Karen? Certainly could be. Now it doesn't necessarily worry me. Like I'm not going to see it. Obviously, it didn't scare me away. If anything, it sort of made me a little bit more interested. But I am a little concerned on how long it is. You know,
what do we have? What's
I mean? Are we going to have like a skinnamarink situation on our hands?
Well, that
here?
Made me wonder if. That same woman you were just talking about, not knowing what was going on, loved Skinamarink and got a lot out of it. Because
yeah.
I would be very surprised if Ari Aster blows it on his third film.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen. So I'm curious about this suspicious moviegoer that was interviewed.
Yeah. But here, the runtime is 2 hours and 59 minutes.
That's long. That's Braveheart long. That's Gettysburg
long. That's very long.
Granted, Midsommar was initially supposed to be 30 minutes longer, which would have brought it in that same department.
That's right.
I want to see the extended version. I want to see what's going on with that.
I'll say this. I remember in the movie theater feeling that Midsommar was really long. I know it felt long as a moviegoer. But I still liked it, you know?
So, I think it was meant to feel long and painful because it thematically worked with what was going on in that film. But yeah, I'm ready for a three-hour movie. I got sized for a new catheter, so I'm good in that department. And I'm looking into new colostomy bags, too. So I'll go in there, and I'll be good to go. I won't even have to get up. I won't miss a second.
What about everyone sitting around you, though? Yikes.
that's
their thoughts.
I'll be in the back row. I love the back row the best. So.
Yeah. So let's talk about the trailer then a little bit because it's got Joaquin Phoenix and he certainly can make interesting choices, but I don't feel like he makes bad choices. You know, I don't remember saying, wow, Joaquin Phoenix picks terrible movies.
No. I mean, I've been a fan of his all the way back to Gladiator, and I guess you could say Oliver Stone's U-Turn, where he's TNT, and he'll blow it any minute.
Or what about when he was a child in the movie Parenthood with Keanu Reeves?
You know, it's been so long since I've seen that, which is interesting because Cate Blanchett has a new show coming out with Martha Plimpton, who's also in Martha Parenthood, who I haven't thought about Parenthood, and now it's all over the place.
Now it's everywhere,
Yeah, I don't remember him as a kid. I think the first time I really took notice was Gladiator. I think he was even nominated for Best Supporting for that.
Yeah, he was.
He plays evil so well, and he also plays vulnerable so well, too. You know what? I didn't love the one where he goes around with a hammer killing people. That's fairly recent. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, yeah. You were never really there or something.
Didn't love that one. I understand what they were going for, but it was not my favorite. But for the most part, I completely agree. He doesn't pick bad projects. He just is handed the best, and he's one of these like actors in that age range that really doesn't have like a checkered past too. You know what I mean? I feel like a lot of like his contemporaries now are either canceled or questionable. And for some reason he has managed to avoid any sort of accusations of any nature. You know what I mean? He's not a dick point. Like Christian Bale or a skeezer like Mr. Spacey. So
I mean, before we got on, and this is a different age category, but now I'm not surprised when anybody, F. Murray Abraham just had to make an apology.
I know.
Yes. It says F. Murray Abraham issues sincere apology after allegations of sexual misconduct. I mean, come on. What?
It sucks.
Anyway, you're right.
His show, Mythic Quest, right? Which I want to get into. But I love him, and I'm so bummed to hear that because he was so great in that second season of White Lotus that just wrapped up. And additionally, I don't know if you remember Dirty Work, but Norm Macdonald makes it very clear that he thinks F. Murray Abraham is the most attractive man to ever walk this planet.
That's right.
Thank you, Norm. R.I.P., baby. Because I totally agree.
Those are great points. but you're absolutely right about Joaquin. We don't know everything about him, but we certainly know that he doesn't have any of these crazy allegations. So he's had a really long, great career. And I just see him now really taking off. I mean, winning an Oscar, Academy Award for The Joker. He's got the sequel coming up. I don't see... Or Napoleon. He's got Napoleon coming out.
I just don't see him.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be Napoleon. So let's talk about what you think this movie is about. Because I haven't, like you said, I haven't done much digging, but I've seen the trailer several times now. And it seems like a journey of a man. Maybe because we see this childlike version of him, which looks amazing.
It's insane. And that's not him. That's like an actual kid that just... uncannily similar in nature because when I first saw the preview I thought it was some sort of CGI going on with this kid
and right
then, but it's not
that's... I thought it was AI
because the Joaquin kid looks Phoenix. Old but young, you know what I mean? It's a very unique looking child actor, but I completely agree. It's a journey of sorts in the vein, I would say, like of a Kaufman, Jones, Gondry-esque sort of like surrealistic existential fever dream that involves like time warping and emotional journeys. And it seems so multi-genre that I'm ecstatic. You know, the movie I think it was reminiscent the most of for me was Synecdoche, New York with Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's Philip sort of Hoffman. Like the long game introspective tale that I think he's going to try to tell with Joaquin Phoenix's bow.
I mean, there's a scene in this trailer that makes him look like he's straight up in the movie Misery. You know?
Yes, he's got some sort of like monitor on his leg. And then interestingly, Nathan Lane is there. I'm not sure what the relationship is, but it's some sort of health monitor. It didn't seem like it's a jail sort of thing. So I think... Because I rewatched both Midsommar and Hereditary, and I was trying to look at like what were the focuses, how are they similar, how are they different, and in Hereditary, for those who have seen it, there's like this otherworldly powers, you know, essentially a prince of hell is kind of like our big bad, our motivating impetus forward, whereas in Midsommar, it's this like actual corporeal, it's the, if you remember, the inbred prophet of the cult in Sweden who kind of like makes the laws of their religion, their cult or whatever. So you have like this otherworldly, and then you have like this sort of like familial, immediate, like really immediate because they're specifically inbred because they think they have power. So it's like the opposite of completely out. We're talking about like as inward as you get with this incest baby. And now I feel like this is more of the cerebral. We're dealing with kind of mental health issues in a way that has been not as explicit as I think this one will be. They've been implicit in both of them, of course. I mean, maybe even more so with Toni Collette's, you know, breakdown. And I mean, even Danny's breakdown in Midsommar. But this one seems like that is our antagonist. Is what's going on inside Bo's mind, real or not? Whereas we have an extraterrestrial religious demonic being in the first one, and then we have this very corporeal, like, inbred, and now we have, you know, that which occurs in one's own mind as our big bad. Because he also goes a new direction, right? This is his third film. He can't do too much retreading.
Yeah. No.
Do you see that? I saw that in the trailer, at least.
No, I completely agree. I mean, this is the first time I'm watching one of his trailers where I'm like, if this is horror, this is going to be a different kind of horror about maybe a man being trapped in his own brain, you know, that mental health is, and maybe that the whole movie takes place inside of his head, you know. I was going to agree with you that I think the first, you know, the first two movies definitely have major themes of family, and they're not just, you know, family. They're like twisted, dark variations of them. I don't remember reading much about the influence of Hereditary that Ari Aster was coming from, but I do remember when Midsommar first came out, reading that he was dealing with a major breakup in his life, and that's what was the influence on that, and he was writing that right after a major unraveling of a relationship. So I'm wondering if each movie has a much deeper personal feeling, and this is how he copes with it. Okay. And maybe Ari Aster is kind of coming out here and just talking about his own personal mental health or something he struggles with. I don't want to put that out there. I mean, if it's not true, but it certainly feels like he writes from what he knows.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. I am curious now to know what kind of inspired him to do what he did with Hereditary, because you're absolutely right. It really kind of like chastises the nuclear family and
loss, though.
In Midsommar, it's more of like the accumulated family, not necessarily about blood as much. It's more about the sense of unity, the cult. Granted, there's a cult in the first one too. So
That's true.
It doesn't seem like there's a cult in this one.
And I was gonna say, although it does feel like he's being held prisoner in part of the movie, that maybe he is being held by a cult. So I don't want to just, you know, dismiss it completely. It could be
that's
in there.
Interesting. I mean, maybe the cult in this one is like, because this is the first one that's really kind of set in so many different spots, both that look real and unreal. I'm just wondering, I wanted to go on that thread.
Please
mention all of the scenes I saw in the backdrop of this trailer. So you got a cruise ship, you got his bedroom, you got this dark tunnel that he's in, you got this therapist's office, the city streets, you got his dingy apartment building. Specifically, it looks like there's scenes that are intense within the elevator of that building. He's in the hospital, there's a caravan scene, they're in the forest, they're in the kitchen, they're in a cardboard town, some sort of void, they're in the desert, there's a winter state, there's like this masked zone where he's talking to somebody with some strange mask on it.
Right.
Celestial area, I guess. There's a war zone, there's the Wild West, you got some weird government facility sort of thing that's in the sky. Don't know what's going on with that. Some sort of futuristic metal structure in the sky. Obviously, there's a lot going on with like an actual theater too, because not only do we see these scenes of him walking through what looks like, you know, scenery on a stage, you also then get pulled back and you see that you're in a theater too at one point. And then at the end, there's like this farm with the angel, another like sort of like artistic theatrical farm, and there's some angel hanging out there. I just have never seen a trailer that seems to have so many different environs, and given the nature of space in his last two movies, specifically Hereditary, really is all about the confines of that house, and how the house is a metaphor for the festering of some of the characters' brains. In the second one, you have kind of the raw vulnerability of being in this like rural field in Sweden. And there's only three buildings, one for sleeping, one for ritual sacrifice, and one for like food for cooking humans.
And almost completely during the daytime, you know, so it's almost.
Yes. So you got the really dreary, dark Hereditary. Then you got the sinisterly bright Midsommar. And this one just seems like it's running the gamut, you know, there's so much going on there, because that's going to be reflective of one's own inner psyche, which
Right.
I'm a little curious how he's how Keane specifically is going to really kind of take a different approach than Joker, because I know Joker is a superhero movie or whatever, supervillain movie, but at the same time, it was really about mental health too, and that's the role coming off of so fresh that I'm a little worried about
that's
the retreading there.
Yeah.
But it seems like this really does stretch over so much time that might was be what differentiates it from Joker. Character-wise,
that's a really great breakdown. I think you sort of nailed it with all the different not just locations but almost genres. And at one point, it feels like he's escaping like the apocalypse. You know, like everyone's breaking out into end of days actions on the streets of New York City. And
yeah, because you have these weird characters like chasing him. It kind of reminds me of that scene in Being John Malkovich, where Malkovich is in his own brain, you know, being chased by himself. That's the sort of flashes I was getting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, I mean, I don't know, based off the trailer, how I would classify this movie as far as what genre it is. Because it also, I was getting major vibes of, I don't know if it's just me, but What About Bob?
Okay, all right.
Bill Murray doing like baby steps to the elevator, baby steps. And it seems like Joaquin's character's Beau is like, I'm going to see my mom today. And then like he's trying to do this simple thing and yet it's impossible to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's really accurate in a way. He's kind of like a functional Rain Man, because he's obviously got some sort of affliction that he's dealing with and other people around him are impacted by. And like you said, with What About Bob, I mean, Bill Murray's character is like a big man child in a way. That's why he's taking these baby steps. And I get the man boy to the extreme vibe here with Joaquin's characters from what we can see.
Yeah.
I think that's an apt comparison. Sure.
What About Bob means everything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's so sad that we mentioned earlier, our hero's getting crushed. And I mean, actually, it's a combo of Bill Murray being a dick and potentially doing some off-color things as well. And you had mentioned having seen Ant-Man. I just watched it this week. I felt like he was going to have such a bigger part. I was so excited to see him, but at the same time, I was like, oh, God, are they going to... I don't know. It was so frustrating because, in a metaphoric sense, I feel like he's died, and he's not. He's still here, and it's so sad.
I know
those things didn't happen, so I'd get more Bill Murray, more of the mayor of the Quantumania, whatever the hell he was. I think that's really accurate. And you're absolutely right in terms of the family. Specifically, it seems like relationships with your mom in Hereditary is going to be retread here in Beau Is Afraid.
What also is interesting in both films is that you have the loss of family, like right out of the gate.
Yes.
So you could potentially say that, I mean, again, I have no idea what Beau Is Afraid is really about, but what if his mom right out of the gate is dead, but he's still like going to see her, you know? It could be this crazy thematic theme here of losing parents.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a very strong possibility. Patti LuPone is his mom, plays his mom in there.
Yeah.
And she was just on The View. I think she has a substantial part from how they were kind of talking, but you're absolutely right. In our contemporary version of him that we see at the beginning on the cruise ship, where it looks like he's looking over to his younger self, maybe his mom has already died then, and then we retread scenes as his younger self with Patti LuPone, who is no stranger herself to horror, because she's on one of the best seasons of American Horror Story, Coven, for 14 episodes, as well as being in the upcoming Agatha Harkness spinoff of WandaVision. So she's got the witch down.
I read that yesterday.
The sense that one of the hosts on The View mentioned that, like, oh, I hope I'm not like this mom. It just sounds like she's very henpecky, very, very like a protective, overbearing mother that he's dealing with.
Right. That has maybe the root or cause of all of his issues.
Yes, I think that's a strong possibility, because if we look at the blurb here, right, what does it say? I think it literally says the loss of his mom and he's trying to get home. Following the sudden death of his mother, there you go, mild-mannered.
I didn't even read that, I swear to God, and of course it's right the major theme there.
And of course, it's A24. We should never not say that forevermore.
No, right.
We are not effing up lately. So following the sudden death of his mother, a mild-mannered but anxiety-ridden man confronts his darkest fears as he embarks on an epic Kafka-esque odyssey back home, which is totally accurate. The metamorphosis. There's going to be some sort of metamorphosis going on when they talk about Kafka, of course. I'm excited about some of this other cast, too. Let's not mention how exciting it is to see people that wouldn't normally be in this multi-genre, potentially existential horror smorgasbord, right, like a Nathan Lane. Have we seen him ever in something even pseudo-horror? I can't think of one.
No, only Murders in the Building is the last thing I even saw him in. But right is going to say
fun, it's fun murder.
Yes, it's the fun kind of murder.
And of course, you're Amy Ryan from The Office. I'm really excited to see her in something like this, because she's so endearing. I think anyone who was a fan of The Office and, you know, thought Steve Carell was the funniest thing ever back in the day, fell in love with her too on that show. You know what I mean? Because she was
Sure.
version of her. Quirky. So I'm looking forward to seeing her.
Yeah,
because she was also in Murders in the Building as well. So maybe her and Nathan had that connection.
You're right.
The first season of that.
You're very right.
Parker Posey, baby, can never go wrong.
Always.
With Parker Posey.
No, she's the best. She's the best.
And Richard Kind, which I'm totally interested in him being in it too.
Mm-hmm.
He was just in that Netflix one about the creepy neighbors.
Right. The Watcher.
The Watcher, thank you. So he's dabbling. He was in Gotham back in the day too, so he does appreciate some genre. And then I saw low on the billing was Bill Hader as the UPS man.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fun. I knew that Michael Gandolfini is in it as well, who's, you know, really starting to create a film career of his own. Is James Gandolfini's son.
Yeah.
Who hopefully, you know,
did you see that one that he plays his dad?
No, the
prequel to Sopranos,
right?
I didn't see that either. I don't, which is so strange that I didn't go out of my way to see it because I love the Sopranos.
I know.
But for some reason, I just feel like I want to leave it with that black screen the last episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
good there.
I completely agree.
But let's talk a little bit more about how we think he might like overlap with what he's done before and how he might diverge from it, because it seems like in Hereditary, like too much sleep was a problem. And when she was sleepwalking, she literally endangered the lives of her kids. There's the one incident where apparently she had went in there, doused them all in gasoline, lit the match, and she woke up. Too much sleep.
Boy.
And even when she's sleepwalking again, she literally tries to rip her son's head off while he's in bed. And then, of course, in Midsummer, because it's light all the time, we have the lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep,
the problem. So given that it's very clear that he's taking some sort of medications and such, I'm wondering if sort of like the sleep and the unconscious are going to play a similar sort of like huge part. Because the environments in his movie own the characters, you know?
Yes, I would completely agree with that. And I would say it's probably a combination of both, you know, where this could be happening completely in his head while he's dreaming, and who knows what types of medication he's on that could cause these fever like dreams.
Right.
Or
we don't know that
maybe
he's not a schizophrenic or something. We don't know what's going on with him at all.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
And whether or not these are real things or manifestations in his mind.
Oh, right. Because we see him interacting in almost like a cartoon cardboard forest, you know, so
which is very exciting. Infiltrators play a large part in both Hereditary and Midsummer. We see Joan, who sucks in Toni Collette's mom's character and pretends to be part of the loss group, the loss anonymous, you know, when people lose someone, they go to this grief group. And then Joan pretends to be a stranger when in fact she was BFFs with Toni Collette's mom in it, who was the wife of this Lord Payman from hell. you know, and it all had to do with her bloodline continuing on. And then, of course, in Midsummer, you had Pele. Pele was the guy that went to college with them all, who they all thought was taking them on a fun vacation, when in fact he was leading them all to their death. Or in the case of Danny Coronation.
Yeah. It's really interesting that the way Ari Aster can kind of use these crazy devices within his films to sort of already tell you everything that's going to happen.
Right.
Yes. In the case of Hereditary, you've got that dollhouse that's, you know, a representation of their real life house. But then in Midsommar, you know, rewatching it, there were so many things that I didn't catch the first time around. And it's almost just laid out completely there. And do you remember in the scene in the well, obviously the opening tapestry.
Yes. That kind of
lays out
all the acts basically visually there.
Yeah. But did you catch the artwork in Danny's room above her bed, that there is a it's a little girl with blonde hair and a crown kissing a bear.
Oh, wow.
And it's like right there. It's right there. And that's the thing I really like about his storytelling, is that he can be inventive with, like, you know, characters like Pele and Payman, or he can just kind of map out the entire movie right in front of your eyes, and then you not recognize it and go on his journey.
That's what makes his movie so conducive to multiple viewings, I feel like, too, because you just catch so much more. I'm not sure the first time I saw it, I realized they were eating the people that they had gutted and stuffed, that they burned in the house at the end, and the pies, it was human pie. And not sure I caught on to her stuff in the pubes and the pines. I don't know. There was just so much going on.
Sorry, just to jump on that really quick. The thing that I noticed the second time was the drinks. Did you notice the yellow drinks they were drinking?
The shrimp and beef, I thought, no?
Well, no. I'm talking about specifically about the Christian's drink is a little bit of a different color. And there's a very good chance, because everything is yellow, his is orange. It's a very good chance. I forget the character's name, who's kind of obsessed with him putting the pubes in his pie. Yeah, she also, there's a good chance that she's putting her period blood in his drink.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
that's possible. I did actually, when I was doing some research, apparently when he runs out naked too, after they kind of like coerce him into impregnating her or whatever, and then all the women surround him and are touching, and it's like this communal experience, because it's not going to be their baby, it's going to be the cult's baby. But I guess when he runs out, people have noticed that on his willy there is blood. So she definitely was a virgin when this happened. And I don't know, there's just so much little details that he got going on that oftentimes is so, you know, disturbing in itself. That I know. Absolutely. I'm gonna need to see Beau Is Afraid multiple times, because
but that's the thing about, you know, a really good filmmaker, as crazy as some people might describe his films, and or as this woman I mentioned early describing it as almost unwatchable, it's you're not probably on the same experience wavelength that he's
looking for, that sort of wavelength, you know. I mean,
because you should be having a conversation and going back and watching it again, and that's the biggest difference between something like Midsommar and Skinny Marink. You know, like, I want to watch Midsommar because I know there are things that I missed. There's a good chance I really didn't miss anything in the blurry footage.
That's a very good point. I mean, this is why he's an auteur and so few auteurs exist anymore. And Skinamarink is a funny comparison, in that it's like one deep thought that this actor had, and then he applied it to an hour and a half of just boring shit. Deep thought with just boring shit. And Aster just has, you know, like a tapestry of thought interwoven with, you know, like he shows us at the beginning, it's all thought out. It's not one thought. It's this myriad of thought that draws from myth and religion and so much, you know,
Yeah.
It's masterful. I mean, I'm really excited, and that's why I don't trust this woman. You said there was another person. What was their reaction?
I think it may have been a tweet I saw about the runtime being long, too, and just, like, I just think people, you know, it's a really interesting conversation. I think we could do a whole podcast about just the length of films, and I've talked about it before, and, you know, like, Martin Scorsese's new movie's coming out, and it's going to be over 3 hours, and... for somebody who, like, for filmmakers who want you to see their movies in the theater, how they intended it, they're not necessarily making as easy or as accessible. Or because appealing. It's a really fine line of, well, pushing people away from it, from that experience. Right. And like, oh, I'd rather watch 3 hours on my couch where I can pause it and take my own intermission. And,
or do you make the jump to make that then a 4-episode miniseries? And
Right. Well, that's the appeal. Yeah. If you've got a story so long or it's taking this long, maybe it is best divided up. I mean, like Scorsese's Irishman, like, was on Netflix, and I guarantee more people saw it on Netflix than they did in the movie theater, because it came out around the same time to both.
I totally hear what you're saying. From my perspective, though, I can do it. I don't mind.
Oh, same here.
Movie. I think we're the rarer breed, so it might not make it might make sense to then acknowledge there's going to be the director's cut and there's going to be the studio cut, and during the day play the studio cut, and then the final showtime of every day is the full length for those two. Or, you know what I'm saying? I'm just saying.
No, I agree with you. I'm like playing devil's advocate here.
But you're right. You're not bringing in the mainstream audiences. You're not going to make that sort of money that enables the creation of more innovative stuff like this. Because of that, they'll see it as a fail.
Right. I also think it's a big divide on maybe just age, you know, like who is your target audience? I think you and I were probably conditioned to see longer films in the theater. Now you've got a generation of people who really like bite-sized stuff in the palm of their hands.
That's true.
Yeah, or on the seat of their couch. But I remember a time when, like, they would put an intermission into a movie.
Absolutely.
Like Dances with Wolves.
I'll never forget the Gettysburg interview. It was a Tivoli Theater down in Grove. And, you know, it gives you time to get popcorn, take a whiz, and then jump back in. What were you saying?
I missed that. No. I was just going to say, like, you know, there was a time where you couldn't fit some of these longer movies on a VHS, and you had to be two VHS tapes. But I will say this, because I am somebody who appreciates the movie theaters that now have a bar. I like having a beer with my movie, although it does, you know, make you want to use the bathroom. So it's like when I'm going to see Bo is Afraid, probably not going to be able to have a beer. I don't want to leave the theater unless you're going to give me an intermission.
Well, have you been to the new Alamo in Wrigleyville?
Because I haven't yet, but
they make it easy. They have this little, like, light system, and then you write down on a little sheet of paper what you want. You put it there, and they just grab it. You're not whispering over the movie or nothing.
Yeah.
There was a movie.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I've seen the photos, and I remember going to a movie theater in Pasadena that used to, you'd have a little button and you'd press it, and they would deliver your food to you, and like that's.
I mean,
it's pretty impressive.
It really is. I mean, just to think back, like I said, the Tivoli were rickety old seats, and now here I'm going to the Alamo, and you literally get to lie down like it's a bed.
It's that's how Webster is too. Regal Webster, you can recline in it. That's how I saw the latest John Wick, because it's another longer movie. But the thing I do appreciate about these new chairs compared to the old ones, when you're going to be watching a longer movie, they don't necessarily squeak like the old chairs, and you'd be like, oh my god, now I can't move my position because I'm going to squeak.
And the Marge Simpsons of the world aren't usually getting in your way of
the
screen, too. So.
Man.
Yeah, I get that. Speaking of which, do you remember seeing Hereditary and Midsommar in the theater?
I did not see Hereditary in the theater. I remember seeing that trailer when it first came out, though, and being like, oh, my God, I am so excited for this. Do not remember why I didn't. I saw Midsommar at the Logan Theater, which is very much still a traditional old movie theater like we just described. And it was really warm. Everyone was packed in. And I think that did not play into the success for that audience, because people were laughing at the nude scenes and like very immature.
That sucks.
Yeah.
I don't remember where I saw Midsommar. I know I saw it in the theater. I can't recall where, but I do remember seeing Hereditary at the Lake in Oak Park. So another kind of old school one.
Yeah.
It was like marginally packed, but because it was more of an intimate theater, and Oak Park is like where my parents met like
years ago.
So given how much like familial weirdness is in Hereditary, to then be at the rinky dink theater that my parents might have dated at back in the day all alone. It was an experience that I couldn't forget. But I am looking forward to seeing Bo in the theater. I feel like you have to, given what you've seen in the preview.
Same. And I know we haven't done an episode where we talked about all the movies we want to see in the theater, but we are starting to get trailers now for the movies that are going to be released the rest of this year, horror movies.
Yeah.
We have Evil Dead opening this weekend, what I'd love to talk about. We have the new trailer for the new Insidious movie that's coming out. We have the Demeter, the story about Nosferatu.
Yes, cool.
Yeah, I mean, all these trailers are out right now. We've got a lot of great horror coming out this summer. Something I never remember to say on our podcast is, please, if you enjoy this podcast, give it a review on Apple. Please subscribe if you enjoy it. If you're on YouTube, give us a like and subscribe. We would greatly appreciate it. We want to be able to, you know, reach as many people as possible with all of these reviews and breakdowns that we're doing.
I ditto that. Come on, people. Ditto. Give that sweet, sweet love. We're hungry.
Yeah, we just want to, entertain you.
Damn,
are you not entertained?
Can't you see we've been doing these researches? In fact, I guess we'll sort of wrap this up, I think, with some more of the themes from Hereditary and Midsommar that might bleed over, I would say. If you remember, in Hereditary, the father was a psychiatrist. He was a therapist.
Yes.
It's not something that's overt. But then in Midsommar, she is studying psychology. So you have these characters, again, that are just really focused on what's going on in the mind, and then to have Bo be much more overtly about that was sort of like we're studying his psychology, I think.
I will say really quick about Gabriel Byrne's character in Hereditary that I think the biggest difference between Hereditary and Midsommar is that Gabriel Byrne's character was basically us, the audience. He was witnessing all this the same time we were. He was asking the questions that we were asking. And I don't really think we got that in Midsommar. So I'm really curious of that point of view, if we're going to get that in Bo is Afraid, or if it's just from Bo's POV.
That's a really good point, because anytime somebody was sensible in Midsommar was right before they died. You know, for example, Connie, whose boyfriend Simon just disappeared. Speaking of which, I'd love to just talk about the 9 people that they burn at the end of Midsommar, because as noted, he's into myth. Astor's also, I think, very into archetypes. Specifically, like, think about the 9 that are in there. You got the 2 old, the matriarch and the patriarch, right? That throw themselves over to the cliff. They're in there.
Right.
They've got branches in them. So they're about, like, the growth of that unit, that family. Then, I don't know if you remember this, but the guy who's about to be Adam Warlock, who was Joker in Gotham.
Name. Will Porter. Will.
Yes. So his character was kind of the jester, his character Mark. So when they put him in there, he's wearing like this jester thing. So the archetype of the fool, I think,
Poulter.
Is something that really applies to him. You could argue, what's his face? William Jackson Harper's Josh, the dude from Happy Place. What is it? A Good Place?
A Good Place, yeah.
He is the sensible. He's the closest to a sensible person. He's the closest to the dad from Hereditary, I would argue, that we get. He's kind of like the clerk, the intellectual, who does question, who wants to go see what's up with this book, and he's killed, you know, by the inbred bludgeon on the head wearing the face of, what is it, Mark. So then there's your clerk, your intellectual. And then I would argue that our Jack Rayner's character, Christian, who I like this actor. I don't know if you've watched The Peripheral yet on Amazon Prime, but he's good in it. It's
I do like him though.
He's probably like our prince or the warrior figure. I mean, he does end up in the bear. You're sacrificing that warrior there. And then you got the two people from the actual cult who volunteer, and those are like the innocents or the highly religious archetypes. So I just found it interesting that each character in it is sort of, and then of course the lovers. I missed that. Lovers is another archetype. You have the couple, Simon and Connie. I just think it's really interesting the way that everyone that is sacrificed at the end is not the same. You know, they all have a very distinct stock archetypal nature to them, which I think is cool because I think he does play with that. I was reading an article about a theory about Midsummer, how it's a reverse fairy tale. And then ultimately, instead of going to find your Prince Charming at the end, she manages to get rid of him, to kill. She's the one that chooses to let Christian die. And then there was some additional overtones, like how she's acknowledging the essentially the whiteness, you know, if you want to get into racial stuff, where she then adopts this like uniform culture in a way that is implicit in some of these, certainly until like Tiana. But I mean, it's been very highly Caucasian princess destiny sort of thing, aiming toward that. But the inverse of that has occurred. So it's like social commentary on how these fairy tale and princess movies specific, because she ends up the Mayfair princess, right?
Right.
I thought it was a really interesting take. I did want to mention it because I'm curious if there's going to be these additional layers like you can find in, especially Midsommar, but Hereditary too.
I would bet. Everyone has in his films, everyone has a part to play, right? I mean, more obviously in Hereditary, when you're like trying to find a replacement for Payman's it's really, really well thought out, great character developments, and also original filmmaking here.
Which do you find scarier of the two, of his first two?
Hereditary. It has so many great, I mean, not just jump scares, but the creepiness is completely different than the type of creepiness in Midsommar. You have some really effective things done in this movie. Uh-huh. There's like no music. There's like one song in Hereditary. Uh-huh. The most of the movie is like ambience, the sounds of the house, the creaking of the floors.
Essentially Payment.
Yes.
Through the girl. Charlie.
It's more of a traditional horror movie designed in to take place in the shadows, really. And I think Midsommar kind of has more of a psychological creepiness to it than
I get that. I think Hereditary. You're right. Until I rewatched them, I would have said Midsommar was scarier as a whole because of like the implications in it. But having rewatched Hereditary this week, there are such impacting scenes. I mean, the obvious ones are when she loses her head, obviously, but not even that, but him, like his unwillingness or incapacity to tell his parents and to just go up to his bed and, you know, lay there, eyes opened. Another moment that I felt like you've seen it before trope wise, but in this one, it just did it so well when Payman has fun with him in the classroom and uses him like a puppet there, and he can't control his own body. And it's just foreshadowing that he's about to lose his whole body. And then of course you can't negate how freaky Toni Collette is then when she's able to traverse the walls and bang on the attic door with her head.
Yeah.
And then of course sever her own head with the piano wire. I agree. I felt like there was maybe more impacting horror sequences in Hereditary. But I felt like emotionally I was more hit by Midsommar. You know what I mean? Like I said, it's more of a more of the visceral versus the visual.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, after Hereditary, I really didn't think Ari Aster was going to be like, not that he wasn't good enough, but I didn't think he was going to be a horror movie guy. And then to follow up a horror movie, the horror movie is really ballsy.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they can certainly compete with each other, and it's just tough to follow up unless you're Jordan Peele, you know.
Right.
Ari Aster is up there though, and I'm really, really excited to see what type of horror, because I think it's what he really likes, what type of horror Bo is afraid is going to deliver.
Right. And in the next part two, we are going to talk about the project that he has coming up, Eddington, as well as some very interesting titles that he is a producer on that
interesting.
Excite and irk me at the same time. We'll get into that. We'll get into that for the next part two of Bo's Afraid. But anything else you got, my man?
No, just remember to subscribe, leave a review on Apple, follow us on Spotify, follow us on all the social medias, like and subscribe on YouTube. And then until then,
stay alive, soul!